You know, it's really hard, I think, to hate someone if you're sharing a meal together.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organizations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. Today, we're having a conversation with Leslie Sobel and Roy Waterman. Leslie is a research fellow for the Food in Prison Project and the lead author of Impact Justice's recent report, Eating Behind Bars, Ending the Hidden Punishment of Food in Prison. An ethnographer and folklorist, Leslie holds an MA in cultural sustainability with a focus on the intersection of foodways, narrative theory, and social practice art. Roy Waterman is a chef and justice activist who can speak firsthand about the experience of food during incarceration and the important role food can play in supporting reentry. So perhaps we could begin with you and Roy, Leslie, introducing yourself. So if Leslie, you go first and just say a bit about yourself.
Sure. My name is Leslie Sobel, and I'm an ethnographer focused on food. I live in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. And for the last 3 years, I've been focused on the Food in Prison Project at Impact Justice, taking a deep dive into the quality and consequences of food in United States prisons.
Really nice to meet you, Leslie.
Nice to meet you both as well.
Thank you. And Roy?
Yes, how you doing? I'm Roy Waterman. I'm from New York. I live in Connecticut. I've been doing social justice work since 2002, 2001 or so. And I started in this work because I'm a chef. So I started doing corporate catering around New York City. And when doing that, as a formerly incarcerated man, I did everything in my power to try to hide my convictions in the industry I was trying to engage in, because I didn't want people to discriminate against me. I didn't want people to hold things against me. So what I tried to do was just like not bring prison or formerly incarcerated into my food. But I realized I had to cater an event, and it was for 150 people, and I had no idea. I show up, and it's a bunch of young people walking around the room. And this event was done by a judge. And it was basically young people who are on probation. And they basically were giving them awards for like doing good jobs and stuff like that. So they asked me if you want to talk about the food. And I said, absolutely. But it was that moment that I decided to like publicly talk about, I'm also formerly incarcerated. And I started talking about my background, my history, my upbringing. And basically that led to me co-founding an organization called Drive Change, which is a food truck social enterprise in New York City that we built back in 2003. And the purpose of it is to train, employ, mentor to formerly incarcerated young people, teach them transferable skills in culinary arts, hospitality, money management, accounting, but then also transition them into the food world. Because I believe, and I learned this from being incarcerated, that food is the one industry that it doesn't matter your background. It doesn't matter like how much time you did in prison. It doesn't matter if you've been through some things personally through your family. As long as you know how to make good food, you can make people happy. So I'll stop there.
Brilliant. That's the nub of the matter, I think, just there. Thank you very much. So anyway, Leslie, you and your colleagues have produced a mammoth piece of research, which you present in your six-part report, Eating Behind Bars. And we'd like to talk with you about this. Food is such an important, a central part of our lives. How did you get into this work?
You know, when I was in graduate school, I remember having a conversation with one of my colleagues about, we were in a class learning about food and learning about food and culture. And I remember thinking, I wonder what the impact of being incarcerated has on people's interactions with food. And I wonder how people continue to express identity through food while they're incarcerated and food is really limited. And, you know, that was just a quick few minutes of conversation. And then the idea just sort of went out the back of my head of, oh, you know, that would be something that's interesting to look at someday, and then kind of forgot about it. Fast forward a few years later, and I was looking at idealist.org, which is a job posting website, and I noticed a position for a research fellow at an organization called Impact Justice that wanted to do a study into the health impacts of prison food in the United States. And I thought, huh, that's really interesting. And I thought, you know, food doesn't just impact us physically. It's not just the nutritional aspect that impacts our physical health, but also it really affects mental health. It affects people's sense of identity. It affects the ways people behave and interact with other people. It impacts people's sense of self-worth and human dignity. And I thought this, you know, this would be a really interesting opportunity to take a deeper look into this. And I sent in my resume suggesting that we look at these other areas, you know, besides just physical health, and also look into things like how does the eating environment in prison affect people's physical and mental health. And that's how I ended up here. In terms of how Impact Justice started this work, our organization's president, Alex Buzanski, was at an event several years ago, and he heard someone giving a presentation, and they compared school food to prison food. And they said something along the lines of, well, we don't want our school children eating something that looks like prison food, now do we? And Alex thought about it, and, you know, do we want our people who are incarcerated eating prison food and everything that that means? And he went up to this person after the event and said, you know, have you ever seen prison food? Do you know anything about prison food? And she said, no. And that got Alex thinking, you know, I wonder who actually does know about prison food. Does anyone ever actually think about this? It's not something that actually gets a lot of attention. And so that was what started his interest and, you know, made Impact Justice even think about doing this project.
That's really interesting. And I suppose I found it quite fascinating that you were already thinking about things like identity and emotion and how that related to food. And I suppose I wondered about your experience as a food. It sounds like you're a foodie. The fact that you'd being conscious of it isn't just about feeding our physical bodies, but there are so many other meanings for food.
I grew up in a really food obsessed family. I grew up in Florida, where there are lots of orange groves and you know, certain kinds of fish in the ocean around us. And so for me, food was really a way of understanding the natural world around me. It was a way of understanding other places. Like, we would go and visit my grandmother in Baltimore, Maryland, and Maryland is famous for its steamed crabs. And, you know, Baltimore, they have these special cookies. They're called burger cookies. They're like a layer of sort of vanilla cake with a thick chocolate fudgy frosting on them. You know, and every time I would eat those, it would just make me feel like I was in my grandmother's house. And, you know, really deeply taking in the way that we connect food to people and experiences and seasons and places, you know, times in our life, the way that you can taste a candy that you used to like when you were a child, and it just immediately brings you back there. So yeah, to me, food has always been sort of the lens through which I see the world. And it's hard for me to think of food as anything else other than something that's fully representative of ourselves and the way that we interact with others.
That's fantastic. And it just sounds like you've chosen a research area that's very much suited to who you are as a person, which I think enables some kind of having that passionate interest in something does enable people, I think, to get more out of it. But you've alluded to kind of how important food is. And I suppose one of the things working in prison is there are always a lot of complaints about food. I guess you're aware of that, Roy. And, you know, obviously the prison catering budget in the UK is £1.87 per prisoner per day. Young offenders get kind of like double that. So I suppose that's probably about $3 American-wise. Is that a similar amount in the US?
It ranges. It's different in each state. So we have sort of three different prison systems in this country. We have the federal prison system. We have the state prison systems. Each state runs its own. And then we have local or county systems, which are usually just one or a few facilities that are very local to a particular area. In terms of our research with Impact Justice, we were mostly investigating the state prisons. And in terms of the state budgets, they really range from not much over $1 to the highest we found was, I think, $4.50. And that's per person per day, not per meal.
Gosh. So do you think that the complaints are just about the sort of the very small budget that's spent on food, or do you think there are other factors that feed into the complaints about food?
I think even bigger than the budget, and Roy, I bet you'll probably also have a lot to say about this, but I think even more so than the budget is really attitudes towards people who are incarcerated or about people who are incarcerated. I think there's this sense that people who have committed harm are not deserving of good food, that they should be further punished through food. I think there's also this, you know, this lack of deep knowledge about how profound the impacts of food are. And I think if people were maybe more aware of that, I would hope that in addition to looking at the attitudes we have towards people who are incarcerated, that would maybe make people think twice.
What are your thoughts, Roy?
To echo what Leslie just talked about, when we're talking about humanity and human decency, it's absent a lot of times when we think about punishment, right? It's hard to understand the difference of punishing a person for a crime, but yet, you know what? That's not enough. Instead, what I want to do, I want to give you a dysfunctional medical system for you, for us to like use generic drugs on you. We want to misdiagnose you. We want to like give you food that we wouldn't give to animals. So when you think of human dignity, we have to think about people in prison. And I'm big on language. So I know in the UK, you might use a lot of different terms. I think it's prisoner or inmate. For me, I use people in prison. Mm-hmm. Because when you remove the title, the stigma, then what happens is you now have a humanizing effect or impact. So now it's easier for you to look at me as Roy the son, Roy the brother, Roy like, the spouse or whatever, and have that connection. But now if you look at me as Roy the inmate, or if you look at me as Roy the bank robber, if you look at me as Roy the murderer, then when you deal with me, you're always going to have red flags or alarms when you're dealing with me, right? You're going to feel a certain kind of way. You're going to feel uncomfortable. So for me, some of the work I've been doing, not just like through food, because for me, I discovered the power of food when I was incarcerated. I was incarcerated and I discovered the power of a shared meal when I was incarcerated. And also, more importantly, I realized how therapeutic food was. Like, the prison had horrible food. I stopped eating beef. I stopped eating pork, all these things while I was in prison. But the prison I was in, we were able to get about 35-pound packages of food every month from a farmer's market. So with that food, when we had stoves, I was able to, like, you know, cook healthy meals and not like what they were just serving me. And I think it's key when we think about like these systems, because even when you think of like the food truck that I co-founded, Drive Change, when we started that business, we realized that the power of a shared meal, people work out differences, and you go back historically, friends, families, enemies, all had the common thing what they worked their differences over, and that was a shared meal. Look at the old movies, look at the old text, the biblical text, whatever you want to look at. Everything was celebratory things were over food, right? It was power in a shared meal, right? Because you know good food makes us happy, but we also know bad food has the ability of making us mad, right? So it's all about, hopefully, like, you know, the food we're getting is not deteriorating our bodies. And a lot of the food in prison, it doesn't have the nutritional value. Like Leslie mentioned, like people get less than $5 a day. Just think about that. And you think about a place like New York City where Rikers Island is costing you about, I don't know, about $200,000 per person, per bed, per year to be housed on Rikers. But then you say, okay, we're going to give you less than $5 of food a day to survive. So, I mean, it's not just American system, as you know. This is a global issue. When we look at punishment, we think the punishment isn't enough. Even when we think about parole and probation, think of that. You sentence a person to time in prison. So why is it that the person still has to be accountable over and over and still getting hit at a parole board to stay in prison? So all these systems we think about, I always like to say they're not broken. They're working perfectly fine according to the people who built them. So now what we have to do is find the different ways to disrupt and dismantle the system. If Leslie and I and millions of other advocates over here in the United States doing the work through food, incarceration, human rights, dignity, then guess what? We're pulling on this side of the beast. Naomi, David, you're in the UK. We're expecting you to be pulling on the beast from that side. The only way we can topple the beast if we're all playing our respective roles. Only way.
Yeah, I think you raised something really important there about how it is the punishment is not seen as being enough and there needs to be more. And the unit where I work in our high secure prison, one Easter they gave all the men in the unit a Cadbury's cream egg at Easter time, which is kind of like a tiny chocolate sweet. They cost about 50p, and that made tabloid headlines that the men in the prison had been given Cadbury's cream eggs. And you think there's that much resentment at having this. And one of the men said to me, actually they were even out of date as well, so they weren't in date, but the fact there was this resentment over people having a treat within their Easter to celebrate Easter. So you definitely hear what you're saying about punishment seeming to be to some degree what society wants from that.
Yes, when you incentivize people's ability to get released, meaning okay, if you do good for every 45 days, I give you a date. Like when you incentivize things for people who are in prison, it makes them work harder towards it. Some of the most resourceful, the most brilliant minds I have ever met were in prison. Mm-hmm. And I've been a lot of places around this country. I've spoken at a lot of stages and been a lot of places and been in the company of a lot of people who had a lot of money. But the most brilliant minds that I've engaged with personally were people who are in prison. And I've been home roughly 12 and a half years or so, never been rearrested or anything. But I know people who are still struggling with going in and out the system because I realize it's not just about, can you work? It's about, okay, are you mentally stable to work? Let's start there. What happened to you when you were younger? Why do you feel this way? These certain questions we're not asking the people that we need to ask the people, because some of these people never heard that in their life before. They've never heard, what's wrong? How can I help you? So a lot of us are bridged to a lot of people, and we don't realize that for some people, we're their only level of support. Whether you're working in the correctional facility, Naomi, whether you're doing a blog, David, whether you're working with Impact, Leslie, we all are impacting people different ways. And we have to always be mindful that we all have a moral responsibility when we do this work to be the voice for those whose voices are not being heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
That phrase you use about the system not being broke, it's working exactly as it should be, as they want it to be, is very powerful. And I think you demonstrate that in the report where you describe the science and the technology that goes into designing these terrible meals, which have just the right amount of protein, just the right amount of so on and so forth. But of course, they're totally inedible and end up being thrown in the trash much of the time. But I think this is really fascinating, this question of attitude and the public attitude and how much they know. And it really puzzles me. And I was thinking about this in the last few days. How is it that the budget is so small? Well, of course, one level, it's a relatively easy budget to cut. You know, slice off a penny there, 5p there. Yeah, and that means quite a lot of money on the larger scale of things. But I think it's more than that. It's to do with attitude, isn't it? It's just, as you're saying, that it's an additional level of punishment. But I don't think that's made explicit enough. Yeah, I think that's what people want to do. That should be very explicit. We're going to punish people by giving them terrible food.
Mm-hmm. And it's about diverting, right? How, like you're giving people terrible food, right? And you're saying, okay, we're going to spend a lot of money in security. We're going to spend a lot of money in security. But what we're going to do is we're going to minimize the amount of money we spend in food because we need to just give you just enough to survive. And that's how you got to look at it. It is about barely getting enough to survive. Everything else, all it's not about is the shortage of money. Not in the UK, the United States, as you know. We are like what? We're responsible for over 25% of the world's population when it comes to incarceration, but we wake up less than 5% of the world's population. So when you think of those numbers, and you think of how bodies are being warehoused, and you think of the amount of money people are making off of incarceration, then you know it's not a money thing. It's about what we deem to be important. For these people who are in prison, guess what? They don't need the little fancy cakes. They don't need anything extra. They just need enough to get by. And we'll pay these COs six figures every year. But everyone, but you, guess what? We're going to pay you 9 cents an hour. We're going to pay you 10 cents an hour. So we have to look at prison for what it is, and it's the manifestation of the modern day slavery. That's exactly what it is. We have to call it for what it is and not like dance around it anymore.
And Roy, I think, you know, you're making a really interesting point too about it's not really a question of budget, because when we were doing our research, we found that food costs generally only comprise about 4% of a Department of Corrections budget, 4%, whereas healthcare is usually about 20 to 25%, and security is even more than that. So instead of spending the money upfront on food that is actually good for people, that puts them in a better physical and mental state, they're spending it on the response to giving people that poor diet. You know, they're spending it on the medical healthcare that has to be in place because people are eating meals that give them diabetes and hypertension and heart problems. You know, they're having to spend more money on security because, you know, partly because of attitudes like we talked about, but also because when people are eating a diet that's deficient in certain nutrients, people are more inclined to be depressed. People are more inclined to act in aggressive ways. You know, the food that we're eating really does impact our state of mind, and bad diets actually make facilities less secure. So, you know, even as we're working to dismantle the system, like Roy is talking about, you know, the changing people's diet while they're currently incarcerated is a huge step towards public safety for everyone, towards lowering public health costs for communities in general. You know, it's really a win-win situation when people are eating healthy food. There's really no good excuse that any Department of Corrections can give for serving poor food. You know, it's not financially responsible if that's their angle. It's certainly not responsible from a human rights perspective.
And to give you a quick example, is when I was incarcerated in Clinton, Dannemora, which is a max A prison. The prison also is known to house like Tupac and all these other guys. I was there for 5 years.
Where did you say it was?
Clinton, Dannemora, upstate New York. I was there for 5 years, and I went from the main to the annex, where the annex was like a little less security, and we had access to stoves. So I talked about the 35-pound packages we would get. But you had to pay for that. Remember, without money, you can't buy anything, right? And the funny thing about it is an officer owned the farmer's market. So that's the other thing, right? Like one of the officers who was working in the facility was the owner of the farmer's market. This is why you were able to get this food so easily and things like that. But before I was able to like get the food system flowing when I got to Clinton, I started signing up to get kosher meals. And the reason why is because that was the only way you were going to get fresh vegetables.
Well, I did want to ask you about that, because in the UK system, that often happens, that people change their religion to sign up for kosher meals, because I think there is smaller quantities, so they're seen as being better quality food.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So like, for example, in Clinton, you are getting raw carrots, you're getting cucumbers, you're getting apples, you are getting different vegetables. You take them back to your housing unit, cut them up, cook them a little bit. Like, so it was like you were able to get something outside of the mystery meat. You're able to get something outside of the whatever, you know, all the different things that we're trying to figure out. So like, just to like claim something else that you're not, just to get that dietary privilege, if you will, was how a lot of people had to like get something that was like going to be sustainable and healthy to them.
Yeah, that's fascinating. The New York Times article described, I think it's called Mountain View Prison, which is up in Maine, which looked, it looked like a very good system. I think the head of the state system there owns an orchard and a large garden as well. So that sounded like an impressive place. And I wondered if there is a big contrast according to where you are. I mean, looking at the figures in your report, Alabama has a very small budget for, and you might imagine that in Alabama, conditions aren't that great, really. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, the amount that's spent per person per day definitely has a lot to do with the quality of the food, but I would argue it really is also about the attitudes of the people who are in charge. You know, there isn't anywhere that we went to or that we looked at for our report that we would say, oh, this is a model of the right way to do prison food. There were places that had what we were calling more promising practices or better practices in place. And like you said, Maine is one of those. The food budget there is a little higher. The commissioner of the Department of Corrections grew up with an incarcerated father. He's also a master gardener and a beekeeper. So he has a little bit of a different attitude towards trying to make the food healthier. And like you mentioned, Mountain View Correctional Facility in Maine, the food services manager there is an organic farmer. He has been for decades. His personal philosophy is food can be medicine or it can be poison. So again, he is trying to do the best that he can within the constraints of a very difficult system. There are so many still, you know, budget issues, nutritional guidelines, you know, that have to be followed that might not actually be the highest standard of nutritional guidelines. There's still, even there, like there are still a lot of highly refined carbohydrates and things in the meals, but that facility is certainly doing a lot better than most others around the country.
And because, and to add on to that, factor in, because a place like Maine, where you can own a private prison, it's much easier for you to do it there. In a place like New York, where the state owns all those prisons upstate New York, the food to like have a warden or have someone change the food system is like unheard of. All the food comes from like one place. They ship it out all around the country. I mean, all around the state to the different facilities. I know when I was there was a place called Quick Chill. I don't even know if it exists anymore, but before I left prison, state prison, before I went to federal prison, it was a place called Quick Chill. And they were preparing the food in like, I think Oneida County. And they were shipping it like to like different 60 or 70 facilities upstate New York.
Yeah, and just to clarify with what Roy is saying as well, the facility, I mean, it is a state facility. It's not privatized, but the food service managers there do have a bit more autonomy in their purchasing. So they're able to purchase more local products if they want. They're able to have a little bit more flexibility with the menus. Whereas somewhere like New York State or other states that do rely on what Roy was talking about, those quick chill where meals are made in a central facility and shipped out to different places around the country where they're just reheated and served, you know, the food quality does vary. There are facilities in the US that are set up for scratch cooking inside the facility, and there are plenty that are not, that are really just there to reheat food that has already been made, packaged in plastic, has been sitting in warehouses for months or potentially even years.
It's not sounding very appetizing, is it?
No.
Would you say that there's not really much difference between federal prisons and, because you mainly looked at state prisons, I understand. How do federal prisons compare, do you think?
So overall, we surveyed people from around the country and we asked about what kinds of facilities they'd been in and which facilities they'd been in. So many of the people that responded to our survey about the prison food experience had been in county facilities, like county jails first, and they had also been in state facilities, and some of them had also been in federal facilities. So they were able to make those comparisons. From what we heard, food at the county jail level is usually the worst. Food in the federal prison system is usually better than in states or counties, but it's still not good. That was the overwhelming response from our survey respondents. So Roy, I'll let you go ahead and address that from your perspective.
And the fortunate part is I've been in all three places. So I can speak about all three places, county, state, and federal. Like Leslie said, the county level is really, if you think the city and state level is bad, the county levels are much worse. And the reason why is because a lot of times people are just in and out, in and out, in and out. So you're not going to get the constant complaint of the food because it's a revolving door. People aren't sentenced yet. People are just going back and forth to court, getting bailed out, getting ROR'd. So like all those things are happening. So the county food isn't really like paid attention to, but it's the worst. I was in the county jail for 3 years fighting my case, and it was horrible. And I went from one county jail in upstate New York, and my federal case, when I got extradited to Virginia, I was in county jails down there in the federal system, which was private jails, but they house people who are in the federal system. And the food, like you said, the food was better, but still did not meet the minimum requirements. And then like to zoom out of this for a second and switch a little bit just to like value this in California. I know you've heard in UK there are a lot of wildfires going on in California. Well, they had like teams of people who were incarcerated at the city level who were fighting the fires. And they were getting paid $1 a day to risk their lives to fight for fire. So like in comparison, when you zoom out, you think, wow, they're giving people less than $5 to eat a day, but they're paying people $1 an hour to walk around with 40, 50 pounds of equipment on their back and fight wildfires. Our systems of oppression.
Yeah, this is very powerful and very colorful stuff you're telling us about here. I'm very grateful to that. And I'm grateful also, Roy, for you raising the issue of language with us. We were talking to a young woman from Oregon a few weeks back who also raised the question of language with us and pointed out how some of the language we were using was not helpful and inappropriate.
And I will send you guys, something called the language letter. A couple of old timers, as we like to call them, two legends, Eddie Ellis and Devon Pryor, who are two men who were formerly incarcerated in New York State, who came home and they created a whole bunch of programs for people while in prison. When they came home, they started this nonprofit called the Center for New Leadership and Urban Solutions. And they created something called the language letter. And it was about using people first language when you're thinking about people in prison, people in any system, welfare system, whatever, immigration. Instead of calling people aliens, why are we not calling them people? Why are we not calling them undocumented people? Like our language in all these different sectors are hurtful. And we were taught something a long time ago that sticks and stones that break our bones and words that never hurt us. And that's a lie. Words have an impact that will take that. I know people that are 60 and 70 years old that are living with the words that their parents told them, you know? So we have to be mindful of the words we're using, because the same way how we can take life, we can also restore life when we're using humanizing language. Like, how are you? You know what? I got your back. You know what? I care about you. You know what? I love you. That's foreign for a lot of people who are going through these systems because of the environments they grew up in. So you might get pushed back initially from the person, because like, wait, hold on, I've never heard that before. You might want something from me. But when you're consistent in what you do and you live in your core values, guess what? Eventually you will penetrate that person. You will. It's like saying good morning to somebody every day. Eventually they're gonna say good morning to you. No matter how much attitude they get, one day they're gonna say good morning to you, right? So it's like learned behavior, and we're creatures of habit. Keep doing things repetitive. Practice. So let's think about people in prison, people incarcerated, people who committed a crime, a person that committed a murder, a person that committed a rape. Why do we have to continue to objectify? As long as we objectify, we're going to continue to dehumanize.
It's so interesting that you're saying all of that, because one of the things that, you know, that I constantly think about is looking at food as a language, and what is the food that we're serving to people who are incarcerated? What is that food saying to them and about them? And, you know, I don't know if you have this also in the UK, but in the US, food will often arrive at a prison marked not for human consumption. And so many people that we interviewed or surveyed told us that they had seen and were required to serve food that arrived in boxes not for human consumption. A lot of that was meat. Sometimes we heard a story about one person who saw oatmeal that had the label not fit for humans and a picture of the head of a horse on it. You know, so sending these messages to people saying you're not fully human, or sending these meals out to people who are incarcerated, basically saying, you know, we don't care about you. You aren't worthy. And the impacts, like Roy was saying, about that language, hearing that over and over again, whether it's words coming from someone's mouth or whether it's coming through the media of food, you know, having that being told over and over again, you're not worthy, you're not fully human, no one cares about you, that has such a profound physical and mental and emotional impact on people that lasts for, you know, years or decades, even after people have been released.
I'm really shocked to hear that about the not fit for human consumption, to be honest with you. I don't think it's that bad in the UK prison system. So the governors of the prison that are on call, they have to check the food as it's been served. They have to eat some of it themselves.
Good.
Yeah, but I guess that's about quality. So I don't think things are that bad in the UK system, but I'm shocked to hear that. It's just so appalling. But even without the not fit for human consumption, I totally take your point about what we serve to people says something about their value to us. Absolutely. And if you're being served up food that's just padded out with white bread and feels like it's of low quality, there is an implicit message of what somebody means or what their value is and what their worth is. Absolutely.
I do think that tasting the food is not the governor's greatest pleasure, because although I'm sure we wouldn't see anything marked not for human consumption, they'd be very careful about avoiding that kind of thing. The food is not of a good quality. And when I go to visit prisons, I'm often staying in a hotel the night before, and I'll take a banana with me and I'll miss the lunch that I'm offered, or I will try it and not eat it because it usually is pretty untasty. So, should we move on a bit? In your introduction, what did you mean by this phrase, the millions of meals being fed to people in US prisons each year do not just impact upon those who are eating them? The huge number of people who have been cycled through the system and their family members experience the impacts in ongoing and indirect ways. Do you remember that phrase?
I do, yes. We often talk about the ripple effect when it comes to prison food. So, like I've mentioned before, the prison diet causes long-term harm. It impacts people's physical health, both with, you know, on an immediate level, people are hungry when they're in prison. 94% of the people who responded to our survey told us that they were always hungry when they were in prison. They didn't have enough food to feel full. So that immediate effect of hunger, but also, again, the long-term health impacts, things like, you know, hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, other gastrointestinal issues, weakened bones because people aren't getting enough calcium, all sorts of different physical effects. And then the mental impacts, like I mentioned before, you know, bad food is depressing in and of itself, but also nutrient deficiencies can further depression and, you know, cause other issues like violent and aggressive behavior or brain fog and clouding decision making. So there are a lot of those impacts. And when people are released back into the community, in the US, 95% of people who are incarcerated will at some point be released back into their communities. When they go back into those communities, they tend to be in worse physical and mental health than they went in. And that's a problem because if people are going back out and they're trying to reintegrate into society and they're trying to serve as parents and family members and neighbors and colleagues, it makes it really hard to be fully present as a partner or a parent or a neighbor, when, you know, you're not feeling well in your body, when you have conditions that could potentially prevent you from finding a job or keeping a job or, you know, engaging with the world in the way that you want to, because you're simply not in the physical or mental shape to do it. And so that has an impact on people's families, you know, when people just aren't fully present or aren't able to engage in that same way. For people whose employment is made more difficult because of the food situation and its impact on their bodies, that, you know, impacts the way that they're able to help take care of their families. Those healthcare costs, because it really is, it's a public health issue, right? We're feeding people food that's pushing them closer to an early death. And that's a huge public health issue. So that money then goes back on taxpayers who then have to pay for healthcare out in the community. And it also leads, again, to communities that are less, potentially less vibrant or less safe, where people are struggling in and of themselves and therefore can't give as much as they'd like to their communities. And all of that together collectively has an impact on our society as a whole. So when we're feeding people poor food in prison, again, it's not just punishing those people in that moment. It's really punishing them for life and punishing their families and communities and basically our whole country.
Which is, it reminds me of, it was back to the thing about language again, and the way that quite often in documentation that people are referred to once they've broken the law and been imprisoned, that they're referred to as offenders thereafter, and then it makes it very difficult for their identity to move on from that. It becomes calcified, and you know, again, the kind of like the food is feeding into that same kind of dynamic, I think, isn't it? That actually you're setting what somebody's set up for after they leave prison is more of the same in terms of the impact on their health.
That's the other trickle down effect, right? So you have the trickle down effect of like the food and what it does to people when they come home and now they need to be on the medical system for a lifetime. But then the other trickle down effect is like when it comes to language, right? The people who are like involved with certain lifestyles who are doing crime and things like that, you start absorbing and adopting those names. You start embracing the names that people call you, which is not a good thing. Sometimes we use it as badges of honor. Yeah, I'm a con, I'm a criminal, I'm a this, or I'm a that. And we don't even realize how hurtful and harmful it is to us. Even the ones who want to be humanized, we use language and words that are, you know, disparaging and like dangerous to us. It is key when you use the language that we use. I've spoken about this for years now. It brings life and it also can help tear down a lot of people. So like it's about like, how do you encourage? How do you motivate? How do you talk about identifying opportunity? Like I always tell people my top five things when I came home, to me, that everyone is key and essential to everyone when they come home, that I had in place was, I had stable housing, I had employment, I had a therapist, right? Those three things I had like set up before I got released from jail and from prison, right? I had a family and community that was invested in my success and my survival. That's key, because as I've spoken to parole officers and probation officers, I always tell them, for some people, you're their only means of support. So when you threaten them with sending them back to jail, when you're talking about get a job or else, it's not a good thing. It's about, how do you get to the place where you're supporting these people and helping them? Because for some, if you've never worked before, and we all know we're never the best employees on our first job, right? It takes time. For a lot of people who've been in prison, they've never punched the clock before. So now here you got a grown man who spent 10, 15, 20 years in prison, comes home, and a parole officer saying, you better get a job or else. And the or else is, I'm going to send you back to prison. So now here you are, a person that's like, man, I've never worked. I've been on 30 job interviews. I was in prison for 10, 20 years and didn't learn much because I was on every waiting list to learn a trade, to learn this, to learn that. And I never got into the program before they shipped me to another jail. These are countless stories of men and women who are going through the system. And we don't talk about women enough, by the way, because they are the fastest growing demographic in the United States when it comes to incarceration. So we need to think about like all of that and like how their needs haven't been met. There are places in the United States still that allow women to pay for sanitary napkins and things like that, which this should be a human right. So like there's so many different layers and tentacles to this problem when you talk about food, prison, humane treatment, conditions of confinement, as well as when people are returning back to what are our returning neighbors? Because that's what they are. They're our neighbors. What does it look like when they come back?
And thank you for sharing that document. And we can make sure that that's available to people who do listen to the podcast as well, because I think that could be interesting. But I think it's interesting, the language, because in UK prisons, meal times quite often get called feeding time, which really just sums up the idea of cattle, doesn't it? So that's something that really jars. But around meal times,
they call it in the UK, they call when it's time to eat, they call it feeding time.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's neat.
It's not uncommon here too, feeding time or chow time. Yeah.
It has all sorts of connotations that are all unpleasant, I think. But quite often there's tensions around meal times in prisons. So it can be a point where people feel slighted by given small portions. People raise concern about the hygiene of the people that are serving up the food. It's also quite a high pressure job, I think. So it's seen as being quite high status because there's the opportunity for perks, the extra bits of extra, bigger portions and so on. Is that also true in the American system?
Yeah, that's pretty consistent with what we found in our research. People who are working in the facility kitchens have the opportunity to maybe take a little bit of extra food to cook something for themselves behind the scenes. People will often, we heard stories about people who would take food from the kitchen, whether that was the occasional fresh vegetable that made its way in or meat from whatever the day's entree is, and bring it back to the dorms and sell it for a very high price, and then could use that money to be able to purchase their own items from the commissary. So yes, that's not uncommon. And it's interesting because we've heard a lot of Department of Corrections people say, people will steal, the inmates steal things from the food or steal things from the kitchen. The inmates will steal things from the kitchen. And, the response to that is always, well, if you're feeding people who are incarcerated enough and you're feeding them food that's good, they're probably less likely to steal things from the kitchen because they're stealing because they're hungry. They're stealing because they're not getting enough to eat and it's not actually nourishing their body. So, what do you expect? And you brought up concerns, Naomi, as well about the hygiene and the sanitation of the kitchen. That's definitely an issue in facilities around the US as well. We heard from people who found shards of metal or human hair or cockroaches or rat feces in their food. We heard from people who said that their hot water in the kitchen never worked and there wasn't ever any soap or cleaning fluid. So the trays and things never really got cleaned and the meals were continued to be served on trays that were never actually clean, which could lead to outbreaks of bacteria that infected people. So, there are dining halls where we heard there was, mold in the walls, and it was visible and it was making people sick. People talked about trying to eat in a room that was either icy cold or way too hot, and there were swarms of insects flying through. So it's really, the sanitation is definitely a question. And in the United States, a lot of facilities here are not necessarily subject to outside inspections. So yeah, a lot of times if a facility kitchen is being inspected, it's by inspectors from that central agency. So they're not having, it's not like a restaurant where health inspectors can come in at any time unannounced and, make an honest assessment of what's happening in the kitchen. It's either inside inspectors, or even if it's some sort of outside agency, even if it's the health department, they're coming in. They have to give oftentimes up to 2 weeks notice. So the kitchen can do some sort of quick cleanup to make it look more sanitary, make it look like they're practicing safe hygiene when they're really not. We heard from a number of people who told us that, once every 3 or 4 months, the food would be decent because they knew the inspectors were coming. So they would serve us a full portion and everything would be clean. And the second the inspectors left, everything just went back to the way it was.
Really important there, I think, as well, about the potential for I suppose, re-traumatization. You know, you've got a lot of people who have often been raised in food poverty. You know, when you refer to, if people are stealing food, it's because they're hungry, right? And actually, when you have people who've been raised in food poverty or been deprived of food as punishment during childhood, and then you have them in prison having the same experience again, potentially, you can see how that's going to bring up all sorts of issues for people, really.
Absolutely. And to go deeper to what Leslie was talking about from an inside perspective, I work in a mess hall for 2 years in Sing Sing Correctional Facility in New York. I was the feed-up captain. So what that means is I used to make the food for all the men who are locked in their cells for disciplinary actions. Meaning if you curse at an officer or if you did something you were supposed to do, they will first lock you in your cell for up to 2 weeks. They call it key lock. You're locking yourself for 2 weeks. While you're in your cell, I would bring the food to you. You would come out for rec once a day, come out for a shower 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And then you would get your food out and I would send out the food, make the food. So I would always send extra food and do that because they love me because of that, because I was in a position where I'm seeing the vegetables come in. I'm seeing this stuff come in. So as much as they talk about how people were stealing things, I wish they had found a way to track how many civilians were leaving the facility with bags of cabbage, carrots, apple, you name it. So it's amazing to me how it's so easy to be like, oh, they're stealing. Because you're going to, of course, it's about like, you know, diversion. Oh, look over there. But really over here, I'm stuffing my pockets, but they're the ones that's the criminal. And a lot of that happens in countless facilities where civilians are taking food out the kitchens. And because they say, oh, you know what? We got a shipment. Let's say the prison holds 1,000 people. And they got a shipment for 800 people of vegetables. They won't serve the 800 servings of vegetables because they don't have 1,000. So when you talk about the theft part, that's what happens. If you work in the kitchen, you'll see the vegetables inside the kitchen. You'll see all these things. I used to cook the food, so I know. It's just that, like I said, there's a lot of different things between the civilians, even the officers, like a lot of different things is going on in there. People are cooking special meals, like, you know, cooking meals for officers, all kinds of off of the food that is for us. So it's a lot of layers to it. A lot of layers to it.
Yeah. Food sometimes comes to represent other tensions, doesn't it? So, for instance, in the UK, prisons with a problem of Islamic fundamentalism, and this is at times being played out over whether it's possible to cook bacon. Do you see food symbolizing tensions in this way in the US prisons?
That's a really interesting question. Mm-hmm. I think there... So we do have quite a large incarcerated Muslim population in the US in many places. A lot of those places tend to serve what they call no pork meals, where just anything that would be pork, usually like sausage or ham, is made from something like turkey instead, so that the whole diet is considered acceptable for people who wouldn't necessarily eat pork, whether they're Muslim or Jewish. That being said, for people who really have a strong belief and strong observance in tenets of their faith, those meals are not necessarily still appropriate for those people. So for example, if you're looking for a diet that is kosher or halal, just because there's no pork in it doesn't mean that the meat that's in it is actually kosher or halal. And we've heard a number of stories from people about folks who are Muslim not being able to get their food after sunset during Ramadan, or being told that if they, you know, if there's a day when they sneak a bite of food at some point when they're not supposed to be eating during Ramadan, they'll be taken off of the Muslim meal plan altogether. So there's definitely a lot of tension, I would say, regarding religious diets in prison. And it's not limited to folks who are Muslim or folks who are Jewish. We heard from someone who was Buddhist and was just trying to get vegetarian food. And, you know, for a really long time was not able to get a vegetarian diet. And when she finally was, the vegetarian diet, and I use that term loosely, was often like, you know, onions and peppers spooned out of the meat stew, or, you know, things that were really not actually vegetarian. So I think there is this sense of, you know, people who have some sort of religious need for, or observe a religious diet, I think there's this sense of, again, not feeling like those people should have access to what they're thinking is, oh, they shouldn't get special food. They're not deserving of special food. So there's this very bare minimum sense of, well, we're going to put on a facade of making it look like we're giving you a special diet, but we're really not actually meeting your religious diet's needs.
You're kind of talking there about tensions between the authorities and the people in prison, but I suppose I was also curious about whether it gets played out as a battle of power between different groups, different gangs of people in prison. So what sometimes happens in the UK system is the whole idea about Islamic fundamentalism is it can be a bit of a red herring around it's ultimately it's about gang stuff. And so there are sometimes wings where other prisoners feel they're not able to cook bacon because they will be they feel coerced by a group who don't eat bacon. And so that's what I was curious about, whether food ever symbolized tensions between groups of people that are incarcerated.
Yeah, no, definitely. As you were talking, I was just thinking like, wow, you know, people are discriminated. Like, I think some of the strongest differentiations between our prison system when it comes to, let's speak specifically about Muslims. When it comes to our prison system in the US and probably in the UK, is that most of the Muslims who are documented in the Department of Corrections around the country, United States, look like me. And if we know the system is built already to oppress people that look like me, then you being Muslim in prison, it's like, oh, you're not special. No, you don't, like, it's easy to discard people because of how they look. And I think that because in the Muslim population in the United States is always continually growing, especially it's like almost like I want to say like it's amazing because I've like kind of like analyzed it over my years in prison. Even when I came home, I'm not Muslim, but I have a lot of friends who are Muslim. I have family members who are Muslim. And it was just amazing to me how I would see so many Black men who would come to prison who would convert to Islam. And in the United States, that number is incredible. So, you know, you get the good thing about that is this, because now you get a population that's growing in one facility, what happens is that the strength in numbers influences sometimes the staffs. Sometimes it influences to let them like, all right, you know, it's about 1,000 of us in here. Start shifting it, like, you know, but we know these systems, like we said before, these systems were created to create harm. And we have to stop saying hey, the system is broken. It's created for harm. So now we know that. And it's like, all right, how do we bring humanity into a harmful environment? And that's the tricky part, right? Because here you are in this environment where it's like, all right, I want to do these things for people who are in prison. But then it's like, then in the back of your mind, you might say, oh, I don't want to be too nice because they might take advantage of me. Like, there's always going to be something, especially as a civilian who works in a facility, that you always have to keep in your mind. Because I always like to tell people are people. Like, anyone can be influenced, anyone can be manipulated, anyone can be, like, you know, so you always have to keep certain things in your mind. And it's hard because now you got this in your mind, but then you want to help this person because you see how the officers are treating them. You see how the food system is in this facility. So it's not easy, but like I said, because the Muslim population is continuing to grow, I've noticed before I left, and that was 12 years ago, that there were some fundamental differences in certain prisons because the majority of population was Muslim.
Naomi, I'm really thinking hard about your question in terms of like the interpersonal tension amongst people who are incarcerated. And I don't think we heard any specific stories about that. We did hear from staff that there would often be resentment, like if they took pork out of the meals or made certain things vegetarian, that there would be resentment on parts of the population saying, you know, oh, well, we want our pork back or things mm-hmm. like that. But we didn't hear those stories directly from people who are incarcerated, but it is an excellent question and something that I'm definitely going to ask folks about now. And if I hear anything about that, I'll definitely let you know.
People feel a way about each other, I think, but I think that most of the frustration was towards the staff in the facility, right? Because yes, like you mentioned, you would see, oh, why are Jewish people getting all these kosher items and I'm Muslim, I can't get like the kosher food? Or why is this happening? Or why I'm Buddhist, but I can't get this? So it was always, the tension's always there just naturally because you're in an environment that's an abnormal environment, that's a dangerous environment, that's a life or death situation environment. So that's like thing is always there, right? But then it's then now the element of, damn, I'm hungry. What am I gonna eat? Mm-hmm. And the sad part about it, and it shows you the trickle effect, I've known people who come home and share their stories on platforms with nonprofit organizations. They wave them, they celebrate them, put them on their media package, and pat their face all over the place, but they don't pay them nothing. So like, even when thinking about compensation for people who are formerly incarcerated, when you say, hey, I want you to come do this because I respect your expertise, we don't even respect that. We'll pay Bill Gates, we'll pay Robert Johnson, we'll pay all these people, Warren Buffett, tons of money to come speak when they don't even need the money. But the person that's sharing the story, that every time possibly they share the story, they're re-traumatized and they're breaking down, they're emotional, and they have to relive this trauma. You don't even know that they jumped the turnstile to get to that panel discussion. You don't even know if they ate that day. And these are some things that not just, and this shows you, this is not just a prison thing. This is a nonprofit thing as well. Like the nonprofit sector uses people's stories to get funding, mm-hmm. right? So now what is it like, all right, just don't use my story to dangle me and then you raise $100,000 and then you're saying, okay, I'm gonna try to give you $10 an hour. Like that doesn't even add up to me. So it's about how do we like equity overall, overarching equity. What does it look like once you've been impacted by the criminal legal system and now you're back in society. Now you're trying to like be a law-abiding citizen. Now you want to work. Now you want to do all these things, but you have all these barriers and stop signs and dead ends all around you. And it's like, man, how do I get around this? And I always tell people the key things to me, where I've been able to be successful, I believe, and not be rearrested and not like fall the traps, is the fact of like having a good support system and having opportunity. We don't realize how big it is for opportunity. All of us on this phone has gotten opportunities. This is why we're here having this conversation at one point or another. But also we've all had someone to speak into our lives that spoke words of affirmation, that said, I love you, I got your back. There are a lot of people that don't have that. So now how do we expect them to be successful if they don't have that? So
we've come across another universal here, because one of our previous colleagues that we were talking to, Michaela, described to us how she and her colleagues who were former incarcerated people were often offered a £20 shopping voucher as payment for the speaking time. And of course, it's to do with belittling people and patronizing people, isn't it?
It continues, David, after incarceration. That's why I always tell people, a felony conviction is a lifetime sentence. It's a lifetime sentence. Meaning, I call my felony convictions, I have three of them, I call them the scarlet letter of the 21st century, because no matter how much good I do on this planet, how many lives I impact, no matter what policy I get changed or whatever, in a certain subset of people, I'm still going to be looked at as a convict. I'm still going to be looked at as a three-time, like, whatever, right? And that redemption, as I like to tell people, is part of the thing that keeps me kind of going and keeps me striving for more, because I say to myself, we all have a superpower and we just have to identify what our superpower is. And that's what I call living in your purpose. So now when you identify why you're here and what you're supposed to do when you're here, I think that that's what people say, it's no longer work, right? It's living in your, like what you were born to do. And I believe I was born to like show people like the perspective of prison inside and out, but also show them a completely different perspective by using the humanizing ways. And I think that's important, because the way you connect with people is by what? through pain, through suffering, through strife, but also through joy, happiness, and love. So, I think that it's key that we continue to provide opportunities for people, whether in the UK or the United States, continue to license credentials, professional licensing, not just, you go work at the fast food joint. How about the fact of all right, we're going to put you in a place or position so that you can create a career for yourself, not a job. As I like to say often, jobs are just over broke. We need careers. And what does that look like for people coming home? Because at the end of the day, as I've said this in front of a room of 800 people on the stage in Washington, D.C., I said, would you rather the person in prison not get college, not be fed well, not be treated right, not learn, for your kids can so you can say, my kids went to school. Your kids are not the person that's going to put the gun in your face. The kids are not the person that's going to invade your house. The kids are not the person that's going to steal your car. So we have to think about what does it look like for people coming home.
So in all of this, were there any positive food experiences within prisons, and what could be done to create more positive around food?
You know, I think the most positive experiences that we heard about were actually, as Roy mentioned before, people trying to share meals while they were incarcerated. And in the US, I'm not sure if it's the same in the UK, but we have what's called commissary or canteen, where people can purchase snack foods or basics like ramen noodles and different kinds of sauces and things, and do a little bit of cooking behind the scenes. Now, that's a very complicated matter because the commissary prices are very expensive. If you don't have family members or loved ones on the outside supporting you and giving you money to buy that, your prison job is unlikely to actually cover most of that. While the prices of those things might be the same as they are in the grocery store down the street, when you're only making 10 cents an hour in a prison job, it's not enough. It could be days of work for you to be able to buy a little packet of instant coffee or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people will often share their commissary goods. They will come together and, you know, someone will say, okay, I'll put in two packages of noodles, and someone else will say, you know, I'll bring this other item, and people will use it to create some sort of thing that they can eat together. We heard a story from someone who told us about a time that she and a few friends were gathering bits of food for weeks and weeks before Christmas so that they could make a huge, what they called pocket, which is just kind of a mashup of different snack items and things that was basically made in a garbage bag and mixed together. But they were able to serve 80 of their peers with that, mostly people who couldn't ever afford to purchase anything from the commissary. And that was something that was really memorable for her, just that ability to share food with people. And so again, I think it's important to say that human beings are very creative and very resilient. And you know, food as humans as a whole, incarcerated or not, food is this biological need. We all have to eat to survive. But people in every culture create these traditions and rituals and, you know, complex things out of food to be able to use food to celebrate or to share. And that doesn't change just because people are incarcerated. People are still working with what they have to be able to create something to celebrate or share. And if we're talking about creating more positive experiences, I would say one of those things would be giving people fresh food, fresh fruits and vegetables and things that are actually nourishing, rather than things that are, even when it's a positive experience in cooking together and sharing together, it's still potentially very damaging to your physical health. Giving people the tools and the food that they need to actually have normal food experiences the same way that you would on the outside, where people are still able to interact with food in a healthy way and share it. Because obviously people on the inside are still doing that. It's just in many cases you can get in trouble for doing it, and it's extremely expensive and it's not healthy. So why not make it into something that is permitted and is healthy and actually helps lift people's spirits and improve people's health? In terms of other positive changes that could be made, let's start by just giving people a humane food experience. Let's make sure that the kitchens are sanitary and people won't get sick from the food. Let's make sure we're giving people fresh fruits and vegetables and diets that are actually putting people in better physical and mental health. Let's use food as a way for staff and people who are incarcerated to connect and see each other as human beings rather than potentially as enemies or someone to be feared. You know, it's really hard, I think, to hate someone if you're sharing a meal together. I think Roy mentioned that before. If you're having a conversation over a meal or cooking together, you know, it makes it a lot harder to see someone as less than human. So I think, you know, again, we need to address harm and how we define harm, because the whole system, you know, is really not, it's not fair, it's not humane. And at the same time, food is a really great tool to start looking more deeply at that system and to really work on dismantling it and really starting to see other people as human beings.
I think we first have to stop using food as a weapon. We have to stop using food as a weapon to hurt as well as kill people. And you know, it's weird because in New York State, most of the prisons are in upstate New York. All the prisons are upstate New York, basically. And when we're talking about upstate New York, we're talking about like towns, rural towns, where the only industry in a lot of these towns is a prison. Nothing else. A lot of these towns in upstate New York. But the other thing that's big in upstate New York is farming. And in like when we started, like in drive, to go back to talking about drive change, when we started this food truck, we not only wanted to like train, employ formerly incarcerated young people, but we also wanted a food, we wanted a farm to truck model. So all the food we were getting from were within 150 miles of New York City. And that was key for us because we knew that the people who are impacted by the system represent a community that are food deserts that have nothing but food options of Chinese restaurants, fried chicken spots, and bodegas. So that means fried food and processed food. That is pretty much the options. So we started getting farm food to also cook it for our young people who we had, like we had these 8 young people and like they were eating this meat, but they're like, this tastes different. This don't taste like the stuff I be eating. This don't taste like the chicken I eat or the burgers I be eating. And it's like, well, you see the difference, right? So we felt like, you know what? It was key for that. So now when we talk about the food systems in upstate New York, as I mentioned, the prisons of upstate New York, what a different system to me would look like is using those local farms to provide the food that are in the prisons. And it's funny because what I also discovered when I was part of Drive Change, because we use maple syrup in all of our, the first iteration what we did was we used a French Canadian inspired menu. So we used maple syrup on everything we made. So everything was sweet, or sweet and savory. So what we identified is that the third or fourth largest producer of maple syrup in the world is New York State. And it was crazy because we had no idea. So we're going upstate and we're like looking at these maple farms and maple tapping. And we're like, wow, like, why is this not part of like, you know, another avenue, another stream, another resource, another opportunity for people who are incarcerated as well as formerly incarcerated. Being one of the third or fourth largest producer of maple syrup in the world, and we're not somehow tying that into the prison aspect, I don't understand that. So, like, I think that's a quick fix way. But ultimately, I think that the things that I've seen that have worked for me personally have been facilities who have allowed people to get 35 pound packages of food from the outside. Those to me were the facilities that work. And keep in mind, in state prisons, you have 3 different kind of like security levels or 4. You have maximum state, you have maximum security, you have medium security, you have minimum, and you also have like camps. But the camps, well not, the camps are more federal. And in the maximum state prisons, that means you're in a cell, 30 foot wall, but also in most maximum state prisons, you cannot cook. You don't have a stove. You have even what's called a hot pot or a stinger where you're converting this hot pot to cook food on. You have stingers which are sticking in buckets of water to make rice in. Like, so it's the way people are so creative in prison is incredible. That's one. But when you're thinking about that and what people have to go through to just cook in a maximum prison, there are barriers. But now the medium security prisons all have stoves and microwaves. So now what does it look like now to like have that food for that local farm, have a direct pipeline? So now you're building up the local economy as well as you're introducing people to a new type of food that's healthy, so that when they come home, they can continue to live that healthy, sustainable lifestyle. But it has to start somewhere.
And Roy, it's really interesting that you bring up the stoves and the availability of fresh produce and things through the packages, because that is unique to New York State. And it's not something that happens in other places in the country. New York State is the only place that we heard of that has stoves in some of the facilities where people are able to cook. It's the only place where in the packages that people are able to receive, people can get fresh fruits and vegetables. In other states where there are package systems, it's all processed food. It's all things that are non-perishable. So it's interesting to hear your perspective again, compared to people who are in other states around the country.
The federal system is completely different. The federal system, you cannot get packages from the outside at all. In the federal system, if you don't have the money in your commissary, you can't get it. It's simple. There are no mail-in packages. If you don't have the capital in your commissary, you won't have a sweatsuit, you won't have sneakers, you won't have toothbrushes, toothpaste, all those things you have to buy in the federal system.
We're going to have to come to an end. You've been very, very generous with your time, and it's been a real pleasure talking with the two of you. You've been so interesting and stimulating, and I feel we could go on for hours, but it would be good, I think, if you could just tell us at the end here, what is it that keeps you going? Can you think of a book or a film or a piece of music, anything but food, that you find nourishing?
I read a lot, so books in general keep me going. I currently just started We Do This Till We Free Us by Mariam Kaba, which is a wonderful new book about abolitionist organizing and transformative justice in the US. She's a wonderful writer. I highly recommend this.
Recommendation. There are a lot. Well, I'll recommend a couple books that I think people should read, as well as probably documentaries people should watch. I think documentaries, books are incredible and excellent, but I think documentaries just do something for you visually that give you a visual image in your head. So I would say the things to me that are eye-opening that I feel like everyone should watch that is doing this work, The 13th, that's first and foremost. It's the key about the 13th Amendment and like how in the United States, how we went from a place of slavery to Jim Crow to quote unquote convict leasing to then mass incarceration. And it shows you the evolution throughout the presidencies, each president and the policy they was pushing that created this massive 2.5 million bodies being incarcerated right now in the United States. One out of every three Black men, one out of every six Latinos have a criminal record. So it's just insane. Documentary The 13th. Also, I would say, book, The New Jim Crow, absolutely. Alex Vitale has a book called The End of Policing. That's a very, very interesting read about what does it look like to have a society without policing, right? What is it? Because we're having more and more conversations about abolition and like not having jails and prison. We're talking about defunding the police and all over the place. So that's another key read. And another documentary I would suggest that you watch, which has nothing to do with prison, has nothing to do with like incarceration, is Food Inc. It is a documentary about how they treat animals in like farms and stuff like that, to like where they have farms where like chickens are like in the dark and like it's all kind of mistreatment of food. And I think that when you see this documentary, it will probably shift how you eat. It shifted the way I eat. I stopped eating beef after I watched it. So like it's like a lot of different, so like, yeah. So I'll just go with those, probably those couple different. And also, if you ever come to the United States, please, one last thing. if you ever come to the United States, please go down to Alabama, to the Lincoln Memorial and the Lincoln Museum. I had the opportunity to go down there. I took 50-something Jews to through a civil rights trip for about 4 days through Atlanta, through Georgia and through Alabama. And it's incredible.
Thank you. Thank you both. It's been a really fascinating, really thought-provoking interview. Could have gone on for a lot longer, but we do need to come to an end. So thank you so much.
Thank you both so much as well for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I suppose the thing that I was really shocked by during, and maybe that's naivety, but I was really shocked to hear that the food is marked with not fit for human consumption.
Yeah, that was rather horrifying, wasn't it? But also so blatant. And I mean, I suppose that in my mind is one of the big differences between perhaps the English system and the American system, is that the English system would make sure any of those signs were removed.
I just found it really shocking and appalling. And then I suppose the other reaction I had at the end was when they were kind of like suggesting positives to kind of, you know, positive changes that could be made. And I had a heart sink moment of thinking about Joe Public and how much opposition there is to doing something that is more compassionate and treating people with more decency and respect if they're behind bars, and how hard it is to progress change. And I suppose it just felt like a massive mountain.
Yeah, that was rather chilling, wasn't it? Because whilst we were talking about some of the motivation, clearly some of it is unconscious, you know, the division between the good and the bad, which people seem driven towards. But also, you know, that some of it is very conscious. And you could imagine people saying, well, that's all they deserve. They don't deserve good food. And once you've got to that point, anything can be justified. So one was left wondering about how one can actually make any progress in this area. Well, of course, there are good, strong reasons for changing the structure of providing food. And it's to do with health and health costs and the long-term effects of feeding people a bad diet. And there are real savings to be made there, but they're kind of difficult to measure because they're always quite a long way down the line. The other thing which struck me as being very powerful was the idea that the system isn't broken, it's working exactly as they want it to, which of course is exemplified within the prison system they were describing by the establishment of these food conglomerations, which measure, make, packet the food to very precise specifications. And the end result is garbage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that also thinking then the like you use the word feed, and I suppose it made me think about that's kind of how it's constructed within prisons, as if people are to be fed rather than actually how much value people get out of life themselves by being able to take ownership and responsibility for their own meal and what they ingest. And, you know, if you're preparing people for life outside, surely part of that ought to be about being able to prepare meals and create your own food and your own meals and have control over that element of your life, rather than just be dished up with whatever comes your way.
What was your experience like at Whitemore? What was the food like there?
I have to say it's never looked all that appetizing to me. Also, I've obviously seen food there and also in Leeds prison, and it's never looked that appetizing, or I've never looked that closely, but what I really take away from it is very heavy in carbs and filler food. So you'd see men with kind of like eight slices of white bread on their plate, and an awful lot of kind of like fried or deep fried stuff. And I suppose it has all the same problems that you get in kind of like schools, where anything that's mass produced means that it's not likely to taste that good, because it's got to be kept in a state in order to be served up kind of like some time later, which is not the same as preparing, you know, I wouldn't be happy preparing a meal at home and then my guests get into keeping it warm for an hour or so before I served it up. I would be quite embarrassed to be serving that up, but I can't say I've ever tasted it. But we did have experiences of cooking meals for particular events at certain times, where the whole spur would create a meal together and different people would take responsibility for doing a starter or the main course or the dessert, and it always created a really nice atmosphere. There was a sense, it really brought about a sense of community. An awful lot of effort was made to make sure everyone was catered for and included, you know, whether you were vegan or needed a kosher diet or whatever, there was effort made to make sure there was something that you could eat, and it always created a really nice ambience on the spur on that day because of the effort, even though some people were quite anxious about participating and belonging. How about you?
Yeah, well, generally speaking, my experience is very similar, but I do know that there are kind of areas and islands of good food production. But I think what also happens is that when you get special situations, like I think 20 years ago, Grendon had kitchen pods built onto the side of every wing, and they did a lot of their own cooking and preparation. But over time, that's been eroded, and now all the food is cooked centrally and wheeled down to each wing in a heated trolley. And the same kind of thing happened at Dovegate, where they had special facilities built, but over time, as a cost-saving measure, that was gradually eaten away. Strange use of the term.
Yeah, yes, and it's a shame because, you know, the kitchens that are available to them are so kind of like under-equipped and so small for so many people to be able to, you know, there's competition around getting in them. And yet, but you can see how valued they are, you know, how it really makes a difference for people to be able to cook their own food, or to be in a food boat where they're sharing with other people and that where they're taking it in turns to cook, and what a difference it makes to morale.
I remember paying a visit to one of the wings at Frankland, which is, as you know, one of our high security prisons, and they had a kitchen on the wing there. Bit like Roy was describing, and indeed they did do their own cooking, and they shared meals in small groups of men. It was rather strange to encounter it in that particular place, I have to say.
They do that in the Fen service as well, so they do have a club together to do that, but it's limited by the amount of space, whereas actually you think people who are designing prisons, that would actually be a nice element to, and it encourages a sense of community, doesn't it? That actually, as the guest said, you know, it encourages a sense of community if you're sat down eating a meal together or cooking and planning and working it out.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.